A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rehm, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on October 28, 2001, entitled Detachment, Living Beyond Fear. The texts for the sermon are Habakkuk 1, verses 1 through 5, and chapter 3, verses 17 through 19, and Philippians 4, verses 10 through 13. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
The reading from the present was from a Lutheran scholar in a book on preaching who speaks about the fact that preaching ought to address that facility for surprise in every human heart. And rather than seeing life as closed-ended, instead of that, to point to people as the open end of history, so that the miracle is the miracle that happens out of infinite possibilities, and therefore the miracle is not some intrusion, whether it be compassionate or wrathful, from beyond, but rather that which emerges out of the process of life itself. We then, in so many words, being the open end of history to effect the miracles of newness and new creation. In this present crisis, post 9/11, I have been ringing the changes on the religious dimension of this crisis, because I believe it's a time in which, at least I hope it's a time in which, we'll see that the things that we have stood for are things that are not optional and not merely academic or intellectual, but have to do with a very real existential reality of the global community. That there are two kinds of religion, and that the religion that excludes and divides, that claims absolutes, absolute truth and absolute obedience, that kind of religion has the potential for the demonic. But I acknowledge to you that I haven't been a very good pastor in that I have not dealt with that which is also a very real part of the human scene in these autumn days, and that is the pervasive presence of fear. There's a lot of fear around. A lot of people who are anxious. Now, fear about the situation that is not different than it was before September 11, but fear about the situation that is so obviously the case, our awareness of it post September 11. Scott Peck, in his Road Less Traveled, the bestseller since 1978, begins that volume with the simple sentence, "Life is difficult," in a section, "Pain and Problems." Life is difficult. And a part of the human scene is fear because of our vulnerability. We aren't always conscious of it. We try not to be conscious of it. And yet, it's always under the surface. Fear is a very real part of the conscious human being, because life is perilous as well as difficult. My health, my economic well-being, the well-being of my family, my spouse, my children. all those things that pertain to me personally. But beyond that, since September 11 particularly, the whole global situation where our way of life is seriously challenged, where we come to recognize that that which has formed the context of our well-being, and we have been a people fortunate indeed, that global context is suddenly altered and challenged, and our way of life, not only personally but corporately, becomes into jeopardy. And so I sense that there is this awareness, the fresh awareness, and there is a lot of fear and anxiety, which is a more vague kind of dis-ease. And so what is there to say? Immediately after the crisis, the churches are full, because there is a natural inclination of the human being to seek some answer, some final security. So the churches are full. And about now it's back to normal again, because that doesn't last. That's an immediate kind of emotional response, but it's indicative of the fact that we know that we live in some kind of a mystery, and we struggle for some kind of an ultimate answer to those questions that beset us. But what can we say from a religious point of view, a spiritual point of view, a biblical point of view? What do we have to say as Christian people to that fear that is alive and well in the land, to that anxiety that stalks the steps of people? Well, in times like this, I have over the years gone back to one of my favorite prophets, Habakkuk. It's such a wonderful little short book in the Hebrew scripture. Habakkuk looks around him and he sees things are not well in the society of Judah. And so he complains to God about it. How long will I call about violence and injustice and you don't seem to hear? Verse 5 of the first chapter, something's afoot, something's happening. Watch for it. And then the vision is that Chaldeans or the Babylonians are going to come in and be the instrument of judgment on this unjust society. Now Habakkuk's got a real problem, because Judah's bad, but Babylon's worse. The prophet is struggling with the question of faith and history. The prophet, see, these things aren't new. These questions aren't new. The prophet is struggling with the fact that there's a just God in the world is unjust. How can there be a just God in a world filled with injustice? Doesn't God take note of it? Doesn't God care? Can't God do anything about it? How come? What's going on? Vision comes. God says to the prophet, the just, the righteous will live by their faith. Hold on. Hang on. Trust. Wait. Watch. And then in the third chapter, there's a kind of theophany in which an old psalm from the past is recited, which asserts that God, the warrior God, comes in and finally will make things right. And the prophet who experiences this entrance-like vision comes out then with the beautiful, beautiful words of the text. You can take everything away. No fruit in the field, no olive crop, no grapes, no cattle in the stall. In other words, strip me naked, yet I will rejoice in God. I will exalt in God my salvation. Now, that is a place to stand. That is a testimony of total trust in the midst of total chaos. Somehow or other, the prophet, in his experience of God, his experience of God's movement in history, comes to a place of absolute trust in the midst of all that's going falling apart and going wrong. He will not only trust God, he will joy in God. And if you would, if you'd like to come to my loft with me, I could show you an old dog-eared file in which I have a marvelous series of sermons on Habakkuk from the year 1964. It's shortly after I left this place the first time, when I was given opportunity to preach worldwide on what was then called the Temple Time broadcast. Three sermons, a summer substitute preacher, three sermons on Habakkuk. The first one, where is the God of history? The second one, faith in the God of history. The third one, joy in the God of history. Fantastic sermons. I have them in a little booklet form. I could offer them for the silent auction as well. And it's powerful stuff, you see. Powerful stuff. Because you preach the security that comes from an absolute trust in an omnipotent God. And you say to the people, you may not see it yet, but wait, it's coming. You may not be able to figure it out yet. And all of the circumstances and all of the evidence may be to the contrary, but you trust because God finally will make it right. The God of Habakkuk in that third chapter is a God of apocalyptic. The God who comes in to the chaos of the human situation finally rings down the curtain of history on all of that that is wrong and makes it all right. And I'll tell you what, that is an unshakable kind of a faith, and that works for many people and for anybody for whom that works. God bless you. But it doesn't work for me anymore. That kind of religious experience is no longer that can give me confidence and hope. Because I believe that what I know about the cosmic process, what I know about nature and history's unfolding, what I know about the human being and human society, what I know about 15 billion years and all of that, what I know about that tells me that this is not an invasive, intrusive God. I wonder what Habakkuk would say if he could come back out of the 6th century B.C., and if I could say to him, 6 million of your own people were burned in this 20th century of our modern society. After the Holocaust, who could believe in a God who intervenes? After the crucifixion, who could believe in a fix-it God who pulls the strings of history? There is an eloquent silence from heaven. That kind of God cannot take away my fear, because for me, that would be wishful thinking. That would be psychological brainwashing. I could try to convince you of it. I could offer you that comfort. But I know that around some bend of the road, some tragedy will beset you, some loss will overtake you. And then you'll say, where is that God? And then I'm going to have to say, just wait, just hold on, just trust. No, the problem is with that conception of God, which works so powerfully for Habakkuk. But that doesn't work for me anymore. I can't preach my sermon of 1964. And yet, Habakkuk had a religious grounding, a religious vision, a religious experience that made him invulnerable. It detached him from everything of secondary importance and said, I will rejoice in God, my salvation. In a different context, Paul spoke of the same kind of detachment. He received a gift from the church at Philippi, and in a rather strange thank you note, he says, thank you for the gift, but I didn't really need the gift. What I mean to say is, it was nice of you to remember me, but you know what? I'm okay whether you remember me or not. I've learned how to be abased and how to abound. I've learned how to have plenty and how to be hungry. In fact, I have learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. Now, Paul had the same God as Habakkuk, but that God had drawn near in Jesus Christ, and in Paul there was a very personal sense of the presence of Christ within him. There was a kind of Christ mysticism with which Paul lived, also believing, of course, in the ultimate culmination of all things through the superintendence of God. But Paul also had borrowed a bit from Stoic philosophy, I think, because it's very difficult to distinguish Paul's I am content in whatever state I find myself from the best of pagan Stoic philosophy, which said if you don't desire anything or want anything, you can't be disappointed. If you don't possess anything, you can't lose anything, sort of. And yet again, whether it's Habakkuk or Paul, don't you envy that kind of absolute trust that can face all circumstance that gives evidence to the contrary and says, nevertheless? Well, if I can't image God intruding, intervening, fixing now and again, here and there, am I simply left at sea? Have I then no hope? No, I think not. But it's going to take a different sense of God and God's involvement in our lives and in our history. Rather than an external God controlling omnipotently from beyond, must it not be the Spirit of God that permeates the process of which we are all a part? Must it not be the God within who urges, moves toward life and light and love? You say, well, what do you hang that on? Why, if you're saying, I am saying really that the future and that history is in our hands, I'm saying that. I've said that a number of times here. If God doesn't fix it, then it's up to us, isn't it? And that's a bit scary, because we know ourselves well enough to know that that's a pretty shaky business on which deposit the whole future of the human adventure. And yet, I have to stand there. But it's not just up to us, because there is that within us. There is that in the process. There is that we speak of as the sacred or the holy or of God or spirit, or call it what you will. There is that continues to move toward life and light and love and peace. How do I know that? Well, the Hebrew prophets, they spoke about that time that would come when they would not hurt or destroy on all God's holy mountain. They spoke of the time when the lion and the lamb would lie down together. They spoke about shalom. They could dream it, you see. Way back there, they were dreaming of another kind of reality, of another reality of history. They were dreaming of life in another vein or venture or dimension. And Jesus' whole life was an attack on that system that was dehumanizing and sucking the life marrow out of people. Where did it come from? See, it keeps surfacing, that voice for life and for love and for peace. Gandhi, taking a page out of Jesus' book, was nonviolent resistance, actually moving Britain out of India, changing the landscape of India as Jesus changed the landscape of the world. Ah, but Jesus was crucified, of course. Gandhi was assassinated. Martin Luther King took a page out of his book, and he too was assassinated. Bonhoeffer wrestled with the demonic Nazi power in his own pacifism. He struggled and struggled, and finally he lifted his hand against Hitler. But he knew too that there was another way. There had to be another way. I'm saying that Habakkuk and Paul and Jesus and these figures that loom large in the past, they were rooted in a religious experience, in a spiritual vision. They saw something and seen something, they could not be moved. They saw something, they lived from the inside out, they were centered. And they lived true to that vision, to be sure, crucified, assassinated, hung, whatever. But they knew, and they were not afraid. You know who's afraid? They are afraid who are drawn in, sucked in, to the old global power game of business as usual. They're afraid. And most of us are there. How long can we bomb Afghanistan? Will it work? Of course it won't work. Our world situation today is not about the greatest military might. It's very interesting in our Wednesday night class, Samuel Huntington analyzing the global situation, the realpolitik, from a purely pragmatic standpoint, lays it all out there. The West is declining. We have peaked. We've peaked. We're not a young civilization anymore. We don't have that freshness, that exuberance, that recklessness of a young rising movement. But there are young rising movements, some who've been there before and are being born again. And if you read Huntington, you will find that Islam is a massive hunk of society with a consciousness without cohesion, he says. China, looming large on the future horizon. So what do we do? Our best minds, our best strategists have to figure out. What do they have to figure out? How we can maintain our predominant position. And if you are in the power game, what do you do? nationally. Are we going to build Fortress America with walls higher and higher and higher? What are we going to do in our own societies, our own communities? Build our gated communities more and more secure, more police, more arms? We just spent, what, a contract, $600 billion or something like that for the new generation of fighters. Airplanes, guns, bombs. And it won't work. It won't work. It can work for a while. You can be top dog for a while. You can be top gun for a while. But it comes around. And if you want to play in that game, in that arena, which is the normal, natural, traditional arena of human global politics, you will live with fear, and you have every right to be afraid. Because it's a scary business. And in the end, you end up blowing each other off the map. So, how about that other vision? How about that other possibility? Habakkuk had a certain image of God and a certain sense of the movement of history, and he came to a point where his vision and his religious experience grounded him so securely that he could live. He said, "Take everything away, and I am not afraid. I will rejoice in God." Paul said, "What I've seen, what I believe, thanks for the gift, but I didn't need it because I can be full or empty because in every condition I am content because I am living out of my own center and outward circumstances will not determine my inward condition." Ah, easy to say, preacher. Easy even to believe on Sunday morning in church. But for the rest of the week, that dog-eat-dog world, it's tough out there. And then to believe that no external circumstance can touch my inward peace, it's not easy. And if I suggest that the world needs a total redoing, retooling, you'll say to me, "Naive preacher," like an aunt said to me once, "silly little Dickie." But where we've been and where we are isn't working. And there is an alternative vision. I may not be able with Habakkuk to say some way, somehow, sometime, God's going to make it right. But I can be just as certain as Habakkuk and just as free of fear because I believe that in the process there is an irrepressible persuasion of love that moves toward light and life that cannot be killed. I may not believe with Paul that just shortly the heavens will open and the Son of Man will return in a glorious rapture, but I can be just as serene as Paul, believing that nothing in life nor death, angels, principalities, powers, things in the present or things in the future, nothing in all creation can ever separate me from the love of God in Christ Jesus my Lord, because that is the pervasive intrinsic movement within the whole of reality. How do I know? I trust it because I see again and again, I see again and again, that word surfacing, that reality coming into being I've experienced it. I know it. I know that love, understanding, compassion, I know it's the only way to live without fear, detached from all of that other need of my life to win, to be number one, to achieve. Just let me be immersed in that loving spirit that permeates history and continues to move it without ever finally being defeated. That's my trust, that's my faith. And because it's love and works by persuasion, I have no assurance that it's all going to turn out nice. But by God, when I live by that vision, I will be all right. And you can't defeat me.